You're listening to XT3.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, distinguished invited guests, fellow students, and members of the press. It's with great pleasure that I extend my warmest welcomes in inviting you all here today. My name is Ray Delysard. I'm the president of the Macquarie University Atheist League, and it's with great honour that I will be your MC this morning. On behalf of the Catholic Society and the Atheist League, I wish to thank you all for being here to witness two prominent and distinguished speakers, true titans of the respective cases, championing their cases here today. Before we invite the speakers to the stage, I would like to take a minute to remind everyone to please turn off your mobile phones, or at the very least, turn them to silent, as we don't want them to interrupt our speakers today. Furthermore, I'll kindly ask everyone to show the respect to our invited speakers, as well as to everyone else in the audience. It is our hope that this will be an enjoyable and memorable event for all involved. I will now call on Catholic Chaplain Chris Forbes to the stage to introduce today's topic and our first speaker.
Thanks very much, Ryder. It's actually Chris Gordon. Chris Forbes is a prominent Christian lecturer here, but I'm nowhere in his league. Your Eminence, Cardinal Pell, Mr. Barker, distinguished guests, staff and students of Macquarie University, welcome to this morning's debate, Without God, We Are Nothing. This topic touches upon one of mankind's deepest and most ancient yearnings. Since the dawn of time, humans have had a natural inclination to ponder the existence of a deity, the possibility of an omnipotent being who created us and keeps us in existence. Today, as in ancient times, there are those who question the existence of God, and there are firm believers. We ask ourselves, if there is a God, how should I live? Do I owe him worship? If there is no God, how do I find my moral compass? How should I live? This morning's debate will help us to think more deeply about this fundamental question. One prominent believer in God is His Eminence Cardinal George Pell, the Archbishop of the Catholic Archdiocese of Sydney, who will be affirming this topic today. Time permits me only to mention a few of Cardinal Pell's achievements. Cardinal Pell was born in Ballarat in 1941 and was educated at Loreto Convent and then St Patrick's College. As a young man, His Eminence was an excellent AFL footballer. From his size and stature, we can see that Cardinal Pell was a formidable ruckman. He signed to play for the mighty Richmond Tigers in 1959 in the then VFL competition. However, feeling the call from God, His Eminence sacrificed his AFL career to study for the priesthood. This was a big loss for the Tigers. Apart from a purple patch in the late 70s and early 80s, they have never quite recovered from this. They do provide some comfort for us Carlton fans, though, as they are slightly worse than us. Cardinal Pell studied for the priesthood at Corpus Christi College, Werribee, the propaganda fide college in Rome, and was ordained a priest in St Peter's Basilica, Rome, in 1966. After serving as auxiliary bishop in Melbourne, Cardinal Pell was appointed the 8th Metropolitan Archbishop of Melbourne in 1996 by Pope John Paul II. In 2001, Cardinal Pell was forced to migrate north as he became the 8th Metropolitan Archbishop of Sydney. His elevation to the College of Cardinals was announced in September 2003, again by Pope John Paul II. Cardinal Pell holds a licentiate in theology from Urban University in Rome, a master's in education from Monash University, Melbourne, and a PhD in church history from the University of Oxford. He is a fellow of the Australian College of Educators and a visiting scholar at Campion Hall, Oxford, and at St Edmund's College, Cambridge University. From 1988 to 1997, Cardinal Pell was a member of the National Catholic Education Commission. He was a member of the Bishop's Committee for Education from 1994 to 2001, serving as both secretary and chairman at different stages. In 1989, he was a committee member helping set up the Australian Catholic University and served as the university's foundation pro-chancellor from 1991 to 1995. Cardinal Pell has been the president of the university's board of owners since 1996. Cardinal Pell's commitment to tertiary education is also reflected in the role he played in establishing campuses of the University of Notre Dame Australia in Sydney, giving the east coast of Australia its first Catholic law and medical schools. In 2003, he served as patron of the Capital Appeal of Australia's first Catholic liberal arts college, Campion College. Christendom College in America conferred the degree of Doctor of Human Letters, honoris causa, on Cardinal Pell in 2006, and in 2008, Thomas Aquinas College in California awarded His Eminence the St. Thomas Aquinas Medallion for his services to the mission and teachings of the Church. Cardinal Pell has worked in the field of interfaith relations by attending the Asia-Pacific Interfaith Dialogue in 2004, 06 and 07. Each time His Eminence was chosen to be part of the official Australian delegation led by the Minister of Foreign Affairs. Cardinal Pell has written widely in religious and secular magazines, learned journals and newspapers, in Australia and overseas, and regularly speaks on TV and radio. He was the editor of Light, the Ballarat Diocese magazine from 1979 to 1984, and since 2001 has written a column for the Sunday Telegraph. Cardinal Pell is a well-known public speaker who has toured the USA, England, Ireland, New Zealand, Croatia, Canada and Korea, and every state of Australia except Western Australia. Please join me in welcoming His Eminence Cardinal George Pell.
First, thank you, Chris Gordon, for introducing the Cardinal. It is my great pleasure to be introducing our second speaker for today. Dan Barker became a teenage evangelist at age 15. He did mission trips extensively in Latin America before he received a degree in religion from Azusa Pacific University and was ordained a minister in 1975. He continued to serve as a pastor in several evangelical churches in America. Dan preached for 19 years before losing faith in faith and publicly announcing his atheism in 1984. He tells his story in his books Losing Faith in Faith from 92 and Godless from 2008. Forward by Richard Dawkins. Dan is also an accomplished pianist, record producer, arranger, and songwriter. He produced Christian music for 20 years. Since 2004, he has been the co-president of the Freedom From Religion Foundation in the US, an organization whose purpose is to promote separation of church and state and to educate the public on matters relating to atheism and agnosticism. Dan travels extensively throughout the world to give lectures, perform concerts, and participate in public debates, like here today. He has appeared on numerous national television shows in the US, including Oprah, twice. He was on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart as recently as this week. Please join me in welcoming leading American atheist, Dan Barker. I will now call the president of the Macquarie University Debating Society, Mr. Nick Ferrari, to the podium. Nick will be moderating today's debate, and he will now explain the format of today's proceedings. Thank you, Nick.
I'll keep this pretty short, because I'm pretty sure you're here to listen to far better speakers than myself. What we're going to be running today is a bit of a modified presidential style of debate, which involves one person from each team. Firstly, the affirmative will have 10 minutes in which to make a constructive opening, of which they're going to base the majority of their case, followed by, obviously, the negative will then take the floor to do the same thing. We'll then have two periods of rebuttal from each side of the House to counter the issues which have been brought up by the opposite. Speakers will be given a warning bell either 2 minutes or 1 minute before their time is about to elapse, and they'll be given 15 seconds after their speaking time has elapsed in order to finish up. Following the rebuttal, we'll then move into a period of cross-examination for which the order will be swapped. So after Dan Barker's second rebuttal, he'll move straight into cross-examination, which they can ask questions of the other speaker for whatever they want, and the other speaker has 40 seconds in which to make their response. Following two periods of cross-examination, each side of the House will be given 2 minutes to close their submissions before we open up to the floor to ask questions of either of the speakers, and we'll go through that in an alternating order. So I would like to declare the debate open on the topic that without God we are nothing, and I would invite His Eminence Cardinal George Pell to take the floor for the affirmative.
Well, my apologies to the moderator for jumping the gun. I begin as I did by saying that my claims this morning are quite simple, and that is that it's more reasonable to believe in God than to reject the hypothesis of God by appealing to chance. God as creator and chance are the only two options as an explanation of the universe. Atheists aren't agnostics. Agnostics claim they don't know or they're not interested in this question. Atheists state quite clearly there is no God. For atheists, the universe is the product of blind chance, has no purpose, perhaps just a brute fact. So humans are like the froth on the wave, sometimes pretty, sometimes dangerous, always inconsequential. I believe that goodness, truth, and beauty call for an explanation, as do the principles of mathematics, physics, and especially the purpose-driven miracles of biology, which run at least through this earth. And the human capacities to recognize these qualities of truth, goodness, and beauty, to invent and construct, also call for an explanation. The Irish philosopher Brendan Purcell cites the frequently used quotation from Einstein that the one thing that is unintelligible about the universe is its intelligibility. From the beginning, it's also important to realize that in arguing for God, we're not claiming the existence of a super quality physical cause or phenomenon accessible to science within the universe. God is not some fantastic, hyper-successful UFO, unidentified flying object. The philosopher and the atheist Thomas Nagel explains that the purpose of the God hypothesis is to claim that not everything is physical, and that there is a mental, purposive, or intentional explanation more fundamental than the basic laws of physics, because it explains even them. By definition, God must be self-sufficient, the reason for his own existence, which is a statement that young children and others, initially at least, don't find a very satisfactory answer to their frequent question, who made God? Different categories of believers believe in different types of God. Deists do not accept that God is in any sense personal, but as the supreme being, the creator, the intelligence, which doesn't intervene in the universe. Pantheists identify God with the universe, regarding the universe as a manifestation of God. So then the mighty, often uncontrollable forces of nature often produce awe in every type of person. Monotheists believe only one God exists, and traditional monotheists, such as Jews, Christians, and Muslims, believe God to be transcendent and personal in some superior sense. And there's only one God. There's not a Christian God, and also a Muslim God, and also a Jewish God. There's one God that is described and approached in different ways. In other words, the one transcendent is God is not on our level of reality, not even as a thermonuclear trigger or a giant rocket which set off the Big Bang at the start of the universe. God is beyond space and time, not part of the natural order, and therefore not open to observation by the natural sciences. And hence, therefore, talking about God, we have to philosophize. We're going with or after physics, we're doing metaphysics. We're philosophizing. I've got quite a splendid book here by a fellow called Anthony Flew. He was his publicists claim that he used to be the best-known atheist in the world, British philosopher. It's a splendidly written, and he's now discovered God. It's a beautifully written book and very accessible. So whether you believe or don't believe in God, this is as good a case you'll get rationally for the existence of God. His most controversial claim in the book is, as I quote, that of all the discoveries of modern science, the greatest discovery of modern science is God. This is provocative for unbelievers, especially unbelieving scientists, and provocative for believers who know that the roots of monotheism are found with Abraham about 3,700 or 3,900 years ago. I repeat that we cannot arrive to God within the framework of science because God is outside science and time. And I also repeat that the God for which we are arguing is not a God of the gaps. It is the whole of the universe which is not self-explanatory. All us as humans, not self-explanatory. Not self-explanatory. And the infrastructure and elements we understand scientifically, neither are they self-explanatory. Many people over the ages have found evidence for the mind of God in the laws of nature, in their regularity and symmetry, and some now more in the richness and unpredictability of the universe. The law of the conservation of energy, Newton's first law of motion, and Boyle's law, mathematically precise regularities, universal and tied together, are the examples Flew gives as he asks how and why nature is packaged in this way. Flew shows that as well as Einstein, and I'll quote from him, the great scientists who developed quantum physics, Max Planck, Werner Heisenberg, Erwin Schrödinger, and Paul Dirac, were all theists, all believers in God. And even Charles Darwin rejected blind chance or necessity as the cause of the universe and looked to a first cause with an intelligent mind. A number of writers espouse a theory called the weak anthropic principle, which is, and I quote, that matter evolved in an elaborate, finely tuned conspiracy to produce air-breathing, carbon-based life forms possessed of self-consciousness. Others have claimed as much by saying the universe knew we were coming. The universe is finely tuned. If the value of even one of the fundamental constants, the speed of light, or the mass of an electron, had been slightly different, then no planet capable of producing life could have formed. Other examples abound. If the nuclear strong force had been slightly weaker, it's holding the atom together, no element heavier than hydrogen would have been formed. If the Big Bang had been more vigorous, matter could not have formed into stars and planets. If it had been less, probably the planets would have been immensely larger. The one-force strength of electromagnetism enables carbon synthesis to occur in stars, allows stars to burn steadily for billions of years and atoms to exist, and ensures protons behave in a way so that chemistry is possible. This is not the result of blind chance. And neither do we have a satisfactory explanation for the origin of life from non-living matter. For the fact, for example, that every animal for 600 million years has the same body plan, with the exception of the jellyfish. Living beings, or living matter, are purpose-driven and directed. Aristotle, the great Greek philosopher, is evident in their innate activity. The baby moving towards the breast of its mother soon after birth. Of a caterpillar developing into a butterfly. And on top of this, all forms of life are able to reproduce themselves. And new and different species emerge in some mysterious way. Another mystery of life is the origin of the coding and information processes in all life forms. The cell is a system which stores, processes, and replicates information. Flew became a theist. He changed his mind after studying the directive capacity of DNA, whose genetic message is replicated and transcribed to RNA, then into the amino acids, which are then assembled into proteins. How blind and purposeless forces could spontaneously produce such a process is unknown, and I believe unknowable, metaphysically impossible. Even the atheist Nobel Prize-winning biologists like Jacques Monod and the DNA co-discoverer Francis Crick regard the emergence of life from chemical realities as almost miraculous. Crick even believes that somehow inanimate life on Earth was seeded from space with living material. Some have alleged that life might have arisen by chance, but calculations and experiments have shown that the odds to be impossibly high. The moving from amino acids to life, there's one chance in 10 to the power of 40,000, an unimaginable number. The number of subatomic particles in the Eucharist is 10 to the power of 80 or 81. Life didn't come about by chance.
I'd like to thank Cardinal Pell for his insights, and I now call upon Dan Barker to open the case for the negative.
Thank you, Nick, and thank you, George. Thank you, Radar, and Tristan. Where's Tristan? Are you Tristan? Show us your shirt. He's got a great shirt on here. It's big, the big A atheist symbol, and what does it say underneath there? Good without God. So I think you guys have some for sale there. I wasn't going to plug your table, but of course you can be good without God. That's not even an open question. That's just a fact. Millions of good people all over the planet are good without believing in a God. I flew to Sydney last night. This is my first day in Australia. And this is probably no big deal to you, but I saw some wild ibises right out here, which we don't see in Wisconsin, you know. If you saw a wild bear, you'd probably jump, but it's a real pleasure to be invited to this wonderful country. and to see such wonderful thinkers on all sides of the issue, and to be able to debate and dialogue with an informed and compassionate and kind man such as George Pell. Today is, what day is of the week is it today? Thursday. You know what that is? We're honoring the existence of the god Thor. Isn't that the god they worship, Radar, in Norway, where you're from? There you go. So how many of you in this audience believe in the actual existence of Thor? No? And George doesn't either, do you? The only difference between me and George is that I believe in one less god than he does. We all reject beliefs in many types of gods, and I reject belief in the God of the Bible for very good reasons. And of course, I used to believe, as you know, I used to be a preacher. I used to travel the country trying to convert people to Christianity, and I was actually good at it as it goes. I wrote some Christian musicals. I'm still getting royalties today from some of those musicals. What should I do with the money? But I changed my mind, and I wrote some books about it. My newest book is called Godless, and it explains in great detail, more detail than we can talk about tonight, why I changed my mind. So, without God, are we nothing? Let me ask you, atheists and agnostics in the audience, are you nothing? Aren't you something? Aren't we biological animals? Don't we come with instincts and drives and even, as George points out, purpose to reproduce, to live, to enjoy life? Are we nothing? Who would dare insult our species by saying that our wonderful, beautiful, learning, imperfect, and yet struggling to improve species is merely nothing? Maybe people like George, without God, would feel that they are nothing. They wouldn't have those honorifics or those awards granted to them by a church based on an intellectually feeble book, a scientifically illiterate book, a morally inadequate book of the Bible, an entire world religion based upon very poor teachings. Any one of us in this room could have come up with a better system of thought and morality than that book or the church that George is advocating for. We are something. We exist. The reasons I gave for rejecting my original belief in God, which was sincere and deep. I used to pray. I used to feel the Spirit. I used to see what I thought were miracles. I used to see what I thought would transform lives. But I changed my mind because it intellectually does not make sense. It is much more reasonable not to believe in a God than to pretend that these arguments for a God make any sense. Reason number one is that there's no evidence for a God. Come on, if there were evidence for a God, we would have heard it tonight. George would have put it on the table and said, here's the evidence for God. Instead, what we heard was evidence for mystery. And George went out of his way to remind us that his arguments are not gods of the gap arguments, but in fact, that's exactly what they are. Here's a mystery. How do you answer it? God did it. Isn't that convenient? How do you explain the fine-tuning of the initial constants? I don't know. God did it. That's not evidence. If there were evidence for a God, by now someone should have won the Nobel Prize for pointing that out. Of course, George is careful to point out that the existence of God is not accessible to natural inquiry, which conveniently removes it from real investigation. Although I think that Dawkins is right to suggest that a universe with a God in it would be different than a universe without a God, and therefore the question of God is, in fact, a scientific question. If a God does exist, as opposed to not existing, we should have some evidence to show the existence of that being. None of that evidence has been offered tonight, and really none of that evidence holds any water. Prophecies, supposed miracles, answers to prayer, changed lives, the existence of the Bible, the existence of the church, all these things are not evidences for a God. They are evidence for a beautifully creative human species trying to make sense of the world that we live in. The second reason is that there are no good arguments for a God. The first cause, the fine-tuning, the teleological, the design arguments, we don't have time to touch on those or the ontological or the moral argument or any of the others today in this brief debate. But when you scratch beneath the surface, I have to agree with Bertrand Russell that all these arguments boil down to bad grammar. They really are not, they really do not produce the results even that the theists are aiming for. And to George's credit, he even admits in his writings that these arguments could be stronger, but they are what they are. The church has these arguments and they are using them. But when I scratched beneath the surface, I realized that the question that the little child asked, who made God, is actually a very good question. If we have to ask, if we are allowed to ask that question of ourselves in our universe, why is God exempt from the same question? George says, by definition, he necessarily exists. But that's just called begging the question. It's a circular logic. Another reason, number three, is there's never been a coherent definition of a God ever offered. No one has ever defined what a God is. In fact, many of the definitions, including the Christian definition of God, most Christian definitions, define God in ways that are mutually incompatible. It's like arguing whether or not a married bachelor exists. The God of Christianity is a God who knows the future and is all-powerful and has free will, and yet, if you know the future, you can't change the future. It's an argument I came up with called FANG, the free will argument for the non-existence of God. If God knows the future, he is powerless to change it. And to say that he somehow lives outside of time means that he doesn't exist. To live outside of existence is not to exist. No one has ever properly defined the word spirit or spiritual or supernatural. Those are simply words. George, in his works, uses the word beyond and wider. The spiritual word is beyond, it is wider. But what does the word beyond and wide mean? Aren't those dimensional words? Aren't those natural words? Until you theists define properly the word you're using, you may as well just say God is a blah. Because what does the word spirit mean? How do you measure it? How much does it weigh? How much space does it take up? How does the spirit differ from nothing at all? Isn't it just a word? A fourth reason is that there are no good replies to the positive arguments against the existence of a God. Walk into any children's hospital, and you know there is no God. Those parents who desperately love their children, they're praying, they're asking for a miracle, and yet they see those children die horrible deaths at the same rate as random chance. If there were a God, the universe should be different from what it is. A fifth reason is that there is no agreement among believers themselves as to the nature or the moral principles of this God that they are asking us to believe in. You take any moral issue of the day, you name it, birth control, stem cell research, the death penalty, gay marriage, doctor-assisted suicide, you name these issues, you find devout, Bible-believing, church-going Christians and other religious people on opposite sides of those issues. There is no agreement among believers. I think we atheists are justified in folding our arms and asking you to get your act together first before you ask us to join this supposed fragmented cause of yours. Even Paul in the Bible wrote, God is not the author of confusion. But can you think of a single book that's caused more confusion than the Bible? It's all over the place. Catholics killing Protestants, Protestants killing Catholics, Jews killing Muslims, and so on. And yet, all of them supposedly believe in this God. Finally, the sixth reason is there's no need for a belief in a God. Millions, tens of millions of good people, many of them in this room today, do not believe in a God, and yet we have meaning, purpose, love, joy, fulfillment in our lives that is just as amazing and wonderful as those of, maybe even more, because we are not contingent upon a future reward or a fear of hell to get it. So, without God, are we nothing? Tell that to those millions of good people who find that it is true, there is no purpose of life, nor should we want there to be a purpose of life. If there is a purpose of life, that cheapens life. That makes us less. It's like the hymn that says, God, you are everything and I am nothing. If there is a God, we are subservient in the universe. We are secondary. We are children. We are slaves. If there is a God, we are truly nothing.
I thank Dan for his comments, and I now call upon His Eminence Cardinal Pell to respond.
Well, thank you, Dan. I think it's evident that we're talking at cross purposes. I spoke for 10 minutes talking about the intellectual patterns, the beautiful principles, fantastic equations, the miracles of life that are exist within the universe, and say that they require to be understood an intelligence. They can't be just the product of brute chance. Dan says there's only one difference between us, and that is that he believes in one less God. I prefer to put it in another way. I'm offering an explanation, and so far what Dan has done is offered an affirmation, a disclaimer. Now, of course, I realise that atheists exist, and of whatever I meant by without, or whatever the title means, without God we are nothing, is not true in that sense. My claim is that without God there is nothing. There is no explanation. I certainly didn't claim that you can't argue to God. What I said was that in the terms of physical science, you can't argue to God without doing metaphysics, without reasoning about that evidence. But the whole of my talk was to try to spell out the logic of believing in a superior intelligence. And whether that is loving or not, as we Christians believe, I think that's something, it's a big, big help to have a revelation. There are no good arguments, there's only bad grammar. I don't think you can reduce the laws of nature to that. If Dan thinks that the laws of nature are just bad grammar, I suggest he step out the window and see whether the laws of gravity are functioning. The human intelligence has detected and discovered so many of these fantastic exhibitions of intelligence and mathematical competence. Now, Dan seems to think that God is like the bloke next door. He says he can't be a married bachelor. That's true. Can't be. God can't have his cake and eat it. We can't define God, because to define, you put persons in a species. But we can say useful things about God. God is intelligent. God is spiritual. And what is it where he said there's no definition of a spirit? With the kids, I say, think of your parents' love for you. It's very real, very powerful, quite invisible. Honour, forgiveness, disgrace, they're all powerful spiritual realities. The spirit is real. It's just a little bit like the force of gravity. Real, powerful, and invisible. A little bit like the magnetic force that runs between the north and the south, the poles. God is a spirit. God is fantastically intelligent. And God loves us.
Thank Cardinal Pell for his comments, and now invite Dan to respond.
Well, we've just seen two new debate tactics. One of them is to accuse your opponent of failing to rebut your arguments before your opponent gets to his rebuttal. The second is to misrepresent your opponent. I never said that the laws of nature are bad grammar. What Bertrand Russell and I say is that the arguments that theists have used to prop up their belief, those arguments are bad grammar. Suppose, imagine you're going to be killed by a firing squad. You're blindfolded and you're told that there's 100 expert riflemen who have never missed. They're going to be conducting the execution. You hear, ready, aim, fire, and you hear the blasts, but nothing. You're still there. You think, why am I still here? It must be just blind chance. Would anyone say that? You'd be looking for an explanation properly, as George is doing. When you look at the fine-tuning of the universe, why are we here? Why are we not a stillborn dead universe? Does it look like the universe was expecting us, doesn't it? Maybe there was a conspiracy. Maybe all the rifles jammed at once. Maybe they really like me and they missed on purpose. You know, you can think of all these reasons. But suppose you take off your blindfold and you discover that there were 101 prisoners that day being executed. None of them missed. They all killed somebody, but with the 101 prisoners, one of them, by chance, is going to survive. Cosmologists are now convinced, even Paul Davies, who was a skeptic, that some form of a multiverse is most likely, that our particular universe that we live in is just one of billions and perhaps maybe an infinite number of bubble universes within a huge champagne glass. They are now actually finding, I just read in Scientific American, ways that they are able to measure the probabilities of the existence of the different constants within a universe. It is not so amazing that we live in the universe that has the fine constants finely tuned the way they are, because we wouldn't be observing it if we weren't. I wouldn't be the surviving prisoner. It wouldn't have to be me. It could have been one of the other prisoners. In fact, now scientists are sure that George is right, by the way, that if you do mess with one of the initial constants, let's say you have a stack of rocks that's just teetering right in the balance of falling, and you push this rock this way, the whole thing's going to come tumbling down, right? And George is right about that. The fine tuning of the constants appears to be balanced just to support life. But scientists now know that there are other ways to make a universe. If I press up here on this rock this way, but I press down here on this rock this way, I can keep the thing in balance. There are many, many, many more ways for the formation of the heavy elements to have come into existence than just the one way in the one particular universe that we think of. That's not blind chance. In fact, a true miracle, given the number of potential universes, the true miracle would be that no life ever evolved anywhere. That would need an explanation. The fact that life evolved is incredible, but we are incredibly lucky. If you buy a lottery ticket and you win against stupendous odds, are you going to say, wait a minute, the odds were too great, I cannot have won this lottery? Are you going to say that, or are you going to take the money? Right? Obviously, somebody's going to win that lottery, and it just seems like a miracle when it happens to you. Well, we have won a cosmic lottery here. Billions and billions and billions of other potential universes are stillborn. They are dead. There was no gravitational attraction for whatever under these scenarios. So your fine-tuning argument doesn't hold water. Antony Flew, by the way, did not convert to theism. Theism is a belief in a personal God. If you read his works, he converted at most to a weak form of deism, an initial force. He does not believe in miracles. He doesn't believe in revelation. He does not believe in Jesus. He did not believe in any of the gods that any of us believe in this room. Antony Flew is not a theist by even the widest stretch of the imagination, although he did concede scientifically, based on some of the bad arguments, which scientists are now clearing up, about the fine-tuning of the initial constants. And during my second rebuttal, I will address more of George's opening remarks.
Thank Dan for his comments, and I invite Cardinal Pell to take the floor again with some further rebuttal.
Well, I've got Antony Flew's book here, and you can see the title of it, and it's got... originally, why there is no God, and he's crossed out the no, and then he's put why there is a God. He is certainly a theist. He certainly doesn't believe in life after death, at least in this book he doesn't. There is a postscript by Tom Wright, the Anglican Bishop of Durham, putting out the Christian side of things, which Blue doesn't exist, except. But Flew certainly is a theist, not in the full Christian sense. The last time I was speaking to Paul Davies, he certainly didn't believe in multiple universes. Now, he might have changed his mind just recently, but of course there is not a skerrick of evidence for multiple universes. And even if there was, it wouldn't make the atheist problem any less. Matter of fact, if there were other worlds, and Christians believe in another supernatural, spiritual world of angels and things like that, if there were other worlds, it magnifies the atheist problem, because all the problems they have as they fail to explain this universe are multiplied for every other universe that exists. That's no sort of answer whatsoever. Dan believes that life is like winning a lottery. In other words, exactly as I said, he believes in chance. And he said we're very lucky. We are, especially for those of us who live in Australia. But let me just repeat what the odds are. One chance of moving from amino acids to life, not from nothing to something, from amino acids to life, is one chance in 10 to the power of 40,000, unimaginable number. Some have suggested it could have been come about by chance, and so what chance is there that six chimpanzees on on typewriters might produce a Shakespearean sonnet? Somebody got six chimpanzees together and they battered away for 6 months and they never produced one word. They couldn't even get an ah, that is an A with a gap before and a gap afterwards. Our world exists. It requires an intelligence. We have that intelligence. It's quite unworthy to bail out and say that there is no answer. And to slip from saying there is no God and over to the slightly easier position saying, well, we're not quite sure, or putting forward the bizarre theory that life is the result of winning a lottery.
Thank the Cardinal for his comments and invite Dan to take the floor with some further rebuttal.
Of course, if there is a God who created all of this, he has an intelligence that is functioning in a finely tuned way. This God has purpose, has a direction, has some functionality to its brain and its mind, has desires, has wants, has needs to create things. However you define this God, it is not a simple thing. It is an incredibly complex being. What George has done is he's trying to explain complexity with more complexity. If you answer one mystery with another mystery, you've answered nothing. You've simply delayed the question. Even a child knows to ask, well, if God made everything, who made God? And to simply posit that God, by definition, has his own self-explanation, is to beg the question. You need to give us some kind of an evidence for this being before you posit it as a self-existing being. Paul Davies and I were co-presenters at a conference in 2004, that was 6 years ago, during which Paul Davies said that some form of a limited multiverse is most likely. He has changed his mind. You are right. He was opposed to multiverse, but more and more scientists now are agreeing. The existence of the dark matter, for example, is more logically explained by a multiverse scenario of some sort. And if we can find good models, in fact, two completely different approaches to coming up with a measurement for the probabilities, because you know, the only way to compute a probability is by dividing one number by another. So where do you get those numbers, right? How do you know that those constants could have been different from what they are, and by how much? How do you know that unless you have some sense of probabilities? Two completely different scientific approaches to trying to assess that have come exactly at this, converged at the exact same amount of existence of dark matter that needs an explanation in the universe. Therefore, the hypothesis, and it is a hypothesis, I admit, of multiverses, is mathematically supported, as opposed to the hypothesis, and George admits that God is a hypothesis, of this super complex being up there who doesn't need an explanation for its complexity, although we do. If you're going to pick one hypothesis over another, which one is more simple? Which one makes more sense? You use that number 10 to the 40,000th power. Yes, that's kind of true. Hoyle talked about that, but he was talking about one particular amino acid using one shake of the box. If you had a bunch of random elements and you shook the box once, what are the odds that they would form into that one amino acid? They are extremely high. But 10 to the 40,000th power, which is unimaginably large. But what if there are 10 to the 50,000th power possible multiverses? Then you would expect some of that. In fact, mathematically, it would be a miracle if that amino acid did not form. The problem we have is our failure to imagine the law of large numbers. We evolved thinking in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10, 100, thousands. But if the universe is unimaginably large, then of course, someone's going to win that lottery more than once. Is that the final time? Or is one more minute? Okay. By the way, if monotheism was a great improvement over polytheism, what's the next logical improvement? George makes another assumption in his remarks that that which is mental is non-physical. I don't think anyone supports that claim. I think believers might support that claim. A mental activity is a physical activity. It is a description of a function. Thoughts are not things, they are functions. It'd be like me saying digestion is a thing. Digestion is just a label for the function of an organ. Thoughts and mental processes are labels. It's a label for functioning of an organ. You cannot have thoughts without some kind of an organ functioning. If the stomach disappears, digestion disappears. If the brain dies, our thoughts die. Mental activity is not immaterial.
Before we move to cross-examination, I'll just give both speakers a minute to gather their thoughts for the questions that they'd like to pose to the other side. We'll switch the order here, and Dan will take the questioning role first, with Cardinal Pell answering, and we'll have two periods of cross-examination, each lasting for 4 minutes.
You're listening to XT3.com.
Thank you. And if we could just grab your attention, please, again, guys. Thank you. I now invite both speakers to take their respective podiums. Dan will be questioning first. The way that this will work is that the examiner will be able to ask a question. The opposition will have 40 seconds in which to respond. The examiner can then either choose to interpose another question or allow them to keep answering the current question at their discretion. After 4 minutes, we'll switch who's questioning who. And then one more time for that before we have the closings. I invite both speakers to now take the floor.
Thank you, George. You're very articulate. Good thinker, and good writer, and good man. Can you define for us what, using positive terms, what is a spirit and how that would differ from nothing at all, in positive terms?
I've just said that I can't define God, but I can say something useful about spirit, and I just repeat what I said, because I believe in the reality of love. I believe it's a spiritual quality. I believe honour is something that is real. Disgrace is real. Forgiveness is real. Something spiritual is invisible, but sometimes it can be very, very powerful. The love of a husband and wife, the love between parents and children, they are the most, probably the most important realities in many people's lives. They are spiritual realities.
Okay, let me follow up then. I can define all of those things like love, family, and feelings in purely natural terms as functions of an organism. But why were you not begging the question by saying the definition of spiritual is love, which is spiritual? I want to know what is. Does it occupy space? Does it occupy time? Does it have a weight? Can you measure it along a dimension? How does a spirit, how would you know that your spirit is not just a concept as opposed to an actually existing thing in reality?
Well, you can't measure a spirit. It is certainly not material, but the examples that I have given are very real and very powerful. Now, we can, there's an Australian poet who said that sometimes people can go and be at a concert and be like dogs at a concert. They hear every sound but have got no understanding of the music, because the music is something that is spiritual and beautiful and real. And they can't be reduced to, they're connected with physical activities, but they can't be reduced to those physical activities.
I would like you to give me an example of a positive statement which, if true, would make your God hypothesis false. In other words, the principle of falsifiability. Or to simplify the question, what would you accept as a disproof of your God hypothesis?
I wouldn't accept the reality of evil in the world as disproving God, because that, to argue against the existence of God, we have to use all God's gifts. We have to use reason. And reason, we have to invoke principles. We have to use the great gift of speech. All these capacities are not explicable in themselves. You can say, I don't go down that direction, I just leave it as a brute fact, I got no idea. That's not what you're saying. You're saying there is no intelligent reason for these things. God can't be disproved. We might not believe in him, but we can't disprove the existence of God.
Oh, final question? Oh, which one of these? Which one of these? Which one of these two? Well, okay. Someday, since you probably agree with me that science has not reached the end of the road, there are many unanswered questions, but many of those gaps are closing. We now don't think thunder is caused by Thor. We understand electricity and weather. But someday, when these good questions you are raising about the origin of the Big Bang and the fine-tuning of the initial constants and so on, when science does come up with a satisfactory answer for those questions and we go, oh, aha, we just weren't thinking right, someday when those gaps are closed, will you then abandon your faith in God?
Well, obviously, Dan, you don't understand what the physical sciences are, because the physical sciences do not cope. They do not ask the question, why? And even biologists are notoriously reluctant to admit purpose in living life. I remember Sir Julius Kornberg, a very noted biologist, said that purpose in nature is often like a lady of the night. Scientists will appeal to purpose in nature during in the darkness, but during the daytime they won't admit that there is such a thing in reality. It needs an explanation. Science can't give it, but the more we know, especially about biology, the more evidence is being provided so we can reason about that and reason logically to the existence of a superintelligence, which is God.
Thank Dan for his questions, and it's now Cardinal Pell's turn to cross-examine.
Dan, many things in this life are unjust. 50 million people died in the Second World War, 5 or 6 million Jews, shocking violence. Most theists believe in an afterlife of reward and punishment. You don't believe in a God. What do you say about all the injustices of this world? Is there any remedy for it? Is it just that's the way it is?
By the way, I have no experience with the ladies of the night, so I don't know. And I presume you don't either, so that illustration was for someone else. Since there is no life after death, and there is no cosmic justice, and since there is no retribution in an afterlife, we've got to do it here and now. If we're going to make a difference, we have to do it in this world, which is the only world we have, which is the only world that counts to us. Much injustice will be unpunished. I don't think Hitler is up there somewhere being whipped and beaten. You were a bad boy. He's gone. He's dead. That injustice is forever gone. I think the fact that life is not eternal adds more value to life. Because if you think it lasts forever, well, then let's take care of things in the afterlife instead of taking care of them here. Life is much more valuable, much more precious as an atheist.
I find that very bleak. Now, you mentioned the importance to do something now. So I wonder, where are your atheist institutions? Now, we've got, just in the part of Sydney that's the Archdiocese, we've got 80,000 kids or 70,000 kids Catholic schools. We've got wonderful Catholic hospitals. It's not just Catholic care, but there's Anglicare, there's Uniting Care, that I think over 200,000 person visits in the last year. We believe in the afterlife, but we believe this life is very important, and apparently the atheists do. And, of course, it's not the government, because most of the taxes that are provided for governments come from Christians. This is a majority Christian society. Where are all these atheist groups doing such good work in the here and now, especially as they believe there's no balancing up, the scales of justice don't work later?
Atheists, in fact, have built and do build hospitals. But would you go to the first atheist hospital in Sydney if you saw it? How many people would have a bias against atheism because of those intolerant teachings in the Bible that the fool has said in his heart there is no God? The Soviet Union is one example of a godless country that built hundreds of hospitals who cared about human beings. Stalin was a horrible atheist, by the way. Hitler was a horrible Catholic, by the way. But we should not judge the religion because of the fruits of its followers. It may in fact be true that we atheists are the worst people in the world. We're totally selfish and we're out killing and raping and stealing and cheating. What if that were true? How does that add any evidence for your God hypothesis? All it means is that you Christians are just as nice as the rest of us. When we do good deeds, we're not doing it to trumpet our faith or our institution. We're helping human beings because we love humanity.
No, Dan, you've misunderstood Hitler, Dan, was as much a Catholic as you are a Christian.
Exactly. He was a horrible Catholic.
No. He was as much a Catholic as you are a Christian. You started a Christian and you left. Hitler was a moral monster who hated the church and realized the Catholic Church was one of his principal opponents.
That's an entirely different debate about which you are entirely wrong, but that would have to be an entire evening. But go ahead with your question. What is your question?
The question is, would you believe that we're talking about the reality of the Spirit and the consequence of believing in God and goodness? You misunderstood me. I didn't say that we theists are as good as you atheists. I said our record is enormously better. And you weren't able to produce any local evidence.
Is that your question?
And my question is this. Do you seriously suggest that the production of a Shakespearean sonnet, a Beethoven symphony, the elaboration of the principle of relativity, and could go on, is similar to human digestive processes, as you mentioned in passing, in your reduction to absurdity of the reality of the Spirit?
Yes, it's the same idea, but to a greater degree. In kind, it is the exact same thing. Neurons are firing, emotions are felt, physical processes are happening within a physical brain, which produces what we would call the functioning mind. And if that brain disappears, the mind disappears. So, of course, digestion is much simpler than thought, but they're both functions of a biological organism. And the brain, of course, is an amazingly much more complex organism. So its functions are going to be much more complex as well.
Thank Cardinal Pell for his questions. And it's now Dan's turn again to cross-examine.
It in fact might be true that the atheist view of the cosmos is bleak, but truth is not determined by how bleak something is. I mean, if reality is reality and we don't like what we see, are we going to stick our head in the Christian sand and pretend like it's better than it really is? It takes true courage to face a death with no afterlife. It takes true courage to find meaning in the world. My question to you now, if it's true, as you suggest, that the functional complexity of life requires an intelligent designer, why does not the functional complexity of the mind of that designer also require a similar designer?
Precisely as I set out in my first 10 minutes, precisely because God is not a creature like you and I. The whole God hypothesis is that God is something beyond nature, that he's a necessary being. He contains God spiritually. He's not a he or a she. That God contains in himself, that's an anthropomorphic way of speaking, the reason for his existence and the source of all goodness and truth and beauty. And rather than continually claiming that God is not like the bloke next door, I think you have to grapple with the proposition that is put in about the reality of God.
Well, then, following from that, aren't you admitting to us that your initial premise that functional complexity requires a designer is a false premise? Because if there exists beyond nature, I don't know how that happens, and maybe you can define for us what you mean by the word beyond, something that is functionally complex, that doesn't need a designer, then why do we who are functionally complex within the unit, why do we need it as well? Don't you see the circular reasoning of your argument? Why is your initial premise then valid if your conclusion contradicts your initial premise?
I don't... The whatever else that might be said about my argumentation, it's not circular, because I'm not arguing to someone like myself. I concede that people can say we're confronted by all the beauties of nature, all the goodness of the world. We have discovered many of the mathematical processes that keep nature moving. But I don't know where it comes from. I'm chicken out. I can understand that. But to say there is no explanation for it, which is what an atheist is doing, I think is contrary to reason, is quite unreasonable.
One more question, is that right? Now that we know through science and biology that many other species, dolphins, whales, elephants, chimpanzees, dogs, have altruistic, compassionate, empathetic feelings and behaviors, now that we know that we humans are not unique in that regard, that we are perhaps to a greater degree more empathetic, but now that we see our place within the animal kingdom, and we see that dogs apologize, we see that whales will sacrifice for each other, we see chimpanzees caring and giving and sacrificing. Now that we see that, how can you claim that there's anything special about the functionings of human empathy and compassion? Aren't we all just biological organisms?
We certainly are biological organisms, and undoubtedly the higher animal organisms come closer to us. But we have one gift that they don't, and we have the gift of language, which presupposes thought. So I remember once being asked by a biologist, how do you know the dinosaurs weren't intelligent? And I said, well, I don't think they produced anything, and also they had very small brains. And he said, yes, but there's another thing, and the development of that was an equal miracle to the development of life. He says, they don't have a voice box. And because you need a voice box so that you can articulate your thoughts and explain them and develop them. So no, a dog can grunt and bark and they can show rudimentary sympathy. But I listed the great achievements of civilization. No animal has come within a bull's roar of them.
Thank you, Dan, for your questions. It's now Cardinal Pell's turn to take cross-examination again.
To ask some questions? Good. I believe in truth and goodness and beauty. And I would like to know from your bleak but courageous viewpoint how you explain truth and goodness and beauty.
Well, I don't believe in any of those things, but I accept them as a part of the human experience. Belief is what you use when you don't have knowledge. If the only way you can accept an assertion is by faith, you're admitting that assertion cannot be accepted on its own merits. So I don't believe in those things. Truth, in my understanding, is simply the degree with which a statement corresponds with reality. You make a statement, and if that statement corresponds, we will give it a label of truth. And most truth, of course, is probabilistic, or to a certain degree. Did Homer actually exist? Who wrote the plays of Homer? Maybe, maybe not. We give it a certain degree of confidence. That's all that truth is. Truth is not a thing with a capital T hanging around in the universe. It's the way we measure our propositions and our statements. Goodness is... that was a three-part question, and I only got to answer one part of it. Goodness also is a label. Morality and ethics are a label for how we intend to live in a world with less violence, less harm. So if a mother is hugging and providing for her child, we say that mother is good, right? A mother who is burning a child with a cigarette butt, we say, ooh, that's not a good mother. We measure in physical ways. Goodness is measured in physical, material ways. Goodness is not some ethereal thing that hangs out there. Goodness is a label for those actions and feelings of ours that have the intention of minimizing harm, real harm in the real world. It's much more than that, but there is a perfectly good naturalistic explanation for goodness. Beauty is probably one of those spandrels, a byproduct of our brain. I play jazz piano, and I love playing in the right kind of a combo, and I sometimes say, that's beautiful. We like symmetry. Symmetry is no mystery. Symmetry is when things are balanced, right? We like... your beauty might be my ugliness, who knows what, but beauty is a thing that's happening as a brain perceives its environment. Beauty, again, is a label for a function of a perceiving brain, not for a thing itself that exists in the real world.
Good, Dan, you're talking about goodness as a label and you're espousing harm minimization, don't want to do harm to others. Obviously, then, you would be opposed to abortion in every circumstance.
No, I think abortion in most circumstances is a good thing. I think a woman who has a problem pregnancy, who chooses to have an abortion, is doing the morally correct thing. It is not 100% either or.
No, I'm
answering your question. Excuse me. In some cases, because morality and ethics are involved with minimizing harm. You can't eliminate all harm. So it's usually a conflict of values. So should I vote for stinky or should I vote for bully? I should pick the lesser of two evils, right? In picking the lesser of two evils is a good thing to do. Most Christians think that good and evil are these binary things that's either holy good or holy evil. I think a woman, and this is neither your business nor mine, a woman faced with an unwanted pregnancy, especially if it's a threat to her life, is doing an honorable, good, moral thing to take the freedom of choice to terminate that unwanted pregnancy.
Yes, question. Would it have been, following along these principles of harm minimization, was it a good thing to fight the Second World War? Would we have eliminated, diminished harm significantly if we just rolled over and let the godless dictators, Stalin and Hitler, take over?
Hitler was not godless. Hitler had Gott mit uns on his uniforms. He was a member of the Catholic Church in good standing his whole life. He was never excommunicated by the Church. He credited Jesus as his inspiration for helping to exterminate the Jews. He was a very strange, very bad Catholic, but he was not an atheist. And that's slandering somebody. That's slandering us atheists. But in any event, yes, sometimes in order to minimize harm, you have to create harm. For example, no baby wants to have a needle stuck into it. You think it's a good idea to take a needle and stick it into a baby? Unless that baby needs a life-saving injection. You will cause that lesser harm for a greater good. Ethics is not a simple baby mentality, like a toddler mentality of this is good and this is bad. Ethics in real life is gray. It's in the middle. So sometimes, yes, we have to take violent self-defensive measures with the intention of an end result, if we are as informed as we should be, that has less harm than if we have not done that. So I think there can be some just wars, although we have to be very careful that our motives are clear on these actions that we take.
I'd like to thank both speakers for their questions. That's the end of the cross-examination period. Do you guys want a minute to prepare your closings, or are you right to roll?
Yeah, I think so.
So we'll give speakers 1 minute to prepare their closings, and then it will be Dan to present his closing speech first, followed by Cardinal Pell. I'll just call the House back to order, if I may. And I would like to invite Dan to take the floor to give his closing remarks.
Thank you all. There's too much to say in 2 minutes. But for the record, many of the questions I asked George were not answered directly. The falsifiability question, his answer to the question about what is a spirit included the word power. A spirit has power. But power is work over time, and that's a force, and a force is measurable. So I think there's an incompatibility or a confusion in his definition of what a spirit is. If it has physical effects and yet it's not a physical thing. We could talk a lot more about that. But I just want to end by saying saying this. A lot of people come to their faith in God not by contemplating the ontological argument or by thinking about the number of chances of an amino acid forming a 10 to the 40. No, did any of you come to your belief in a God? Maybe a couple of philosophers, right? Most of you came to it for other reasons, a sense of meaning, of purpose, of justice. And you came to it for other reasons, a sense of community, perhaps, or morality. I said earlier that there is no purpose of life, and that is true. In the cosmic picture, we are just like the dogs. We are just like broccoli. But in the immediate picture, life matters to us here and now. There's no purpose of life, and if there were, it would cheapen our lives. It would make us secondary. But that doesn't mean there's no purpose in life. Atheists and agnostics, and in fact all of you believers as well, you find purpose in life whenever there are problems to solve, whenever there's knowledge to gain or beauty to create or inequality to eradicate or the oppression of women often taken by religious institutions, the denial of rights, such as the denial of gay rights, often taken by religious institutions. As long as there's inequality to eradicate, as long as there are hunger to lessen, as long as there are hospitals to build, as long as there's music to write, there is purpose in life. I'm a father. I have kids. I actually have created somebody. Unlike George, I know what it's like to be a father, I presume. I know what it means to have the paternal feelings. And that gives me an immense feeling of purpose to know that I'm participating in the future of our species. So don't despair that there's no purpose of life, because you create your own purpose in life, which is the only kind of purpose any of us are ever going to find.
Thank you.
Thank Dan for his closing comments, and I now hand across to Cardinal Pell to give the affirmative's closing comments.
I think I heard Dan say in passing that we're like broccoli or a dog. Now, nobody here believes that, not even... Would you go for the broccoli or the dog?
Broccoli.
I suggest that all of us very seriously believe that the great human mystery is infinitely more important than broccoli or a dog. And that's based on the fact that we believe God has created us. The French adventurer and writer, Minister for Culture under de Gaulle, André Malraux, said that no atheist can explain the smile of a child. And Solzhenitsyn, who did more than anyone else to bring down the empire of lies that was Soviet communism, in his Templeton lecture in 83, said, all these terrible things have happened because men have forgotten God. And Milosz, a Polish poet who's lived through communism, Marx spoke about religion be the opium of the people, help them in their sorrows. Milosz said the great opium of the people today is the mistaken belief that at the end of their life they will not have to answer to God for all their lies and barbarities and treacheries and deceptions. The universe doesn't explain itself. Astrophysics, cosmology, all are radically incomplete. I concede that the explanation is wrapped around in mystery. But if we ask the question, we must ponder the answer, and bewildering though it is, that answer men call God. And Dante said that God is the love that moves the sun and all the other stars, and that's my claim.
What we'll be doing now, I thank both speakers for a very good debate, what I felt. I will now be opening up to the floor for questions for approximately 10 minutes, which will start with people that would like to ask Cardinal Pell a question first, then alternating between the parties. So if I could just ask the speakers to once again take their podiums, just to answer questions. I would ask that questions be kept onto within the scope of the debate, and if speakers feel that the question is outside of the scope of the debate, they may ask for another question. Rather than carry my grandparents' back doorbell, which I've stolen to use as a bell for a debate, we'll give 40 seconds for them to answer, after which I will clap loudly. And I think we'll take a question from here for Cardinal Pell first.
In this debate, I heard no reference to the certainty of the divine existence. What are the three certainties of the divine existence? Eternal life, eternal truth, and eternal love. And we were meant to reflect these attributes in our own life, that we have an interplay of love, life, and truth. Where we have an interplay of hatred, deception, and death, which many claim is a fair option, you have problems. You had a Hitler regime was built on hatred, malice, and things. Do you think that's a valid answer to the problems of the existence of God?
I think I'm with you all the way.
Sorry, is there a shorter way to rephrase the question? Based on the three fundamentals of divine existence, love, life, and truth.
That's an inner certainty. Very often, that I meet a lot of Catholics, and I've corrected a lot of people, and don't immediately understand this. And there is the church lacks in understanding.
Well, we're a very imperfect church. I don't say that lightly. I say that with regret. But certainly, we should be. If we follow Christ, we're dedicated to love, life, and truth. And however imperfectly, that's what we're trying to follow and to put into practice.
Thank you very much. We'll now take a question for Dan. If somebody in the audience has one for Dan.
Mr. Barker, you said there was no agreement amongst the people who believe in God. We're working ourselves out. And you said us atheists are standing back with our arms crossed, waiting for an answer. Well, I would say that no agreement amongst atheists, there is no agreement amongst atheists if you look at the forums. And if you look to their explanations, they're constantly debating the issues of science. No agreement, so like the atheists, we're debating the finer points of God. Can you please work out the science and get back to us with an answer?
Yes, but remember, a crucial difference. Theists are making a positive claim. An atheist is a person who is simply not accepting that claim. If I were to claim to you that there are leprechauns in Australia, can I fold my arms and say, disprove that? Who has the burden of proof, you or me? Suppose all of you who disagree with my claim that there are leprechauns in Australia were to disagree with each other about that. Would that strengthen my case? The person who makes the claim has the burden of proof. The rest of us are justified in folding our arms and saying, hey, atheism is not a claim. There's a small subset of hard atheists who say, yes, based on a particular definition of a God, that God does not exist, like a married bachelor. But you're comparing apples and oranges to require of us, those of us who are not accepting the leprechaun claim, the same burden of proof of those of you who are. So first get your definition together, get your moral principles together, get your act together, and then maybe we'll take you a little more seriously. But the fragmentation, according even to Paul in the Bible, said God is not the author of confusion.
Thank you, Dan. And a question for Cardinal Pell.
Sorry, Cardinal Pell, during your, general attack on atheism, trying to take the moral high ground for the Catholic Church, you stated that the Catholic Church had a better track record than atheism. How could you possibly justify that in the light of all of the atrocities that the Catholic Church has committed? You can say, oh, Stalin was an atheist, gulags, etc., killed all of these thousands of people. Then you go through years and years... You go through years and years of systematic child abuse and covering it up, the aiding of individuals who helped in the massacres in Rwanda. How can you say that the Catholic Church has any sort of track record even close to that of atheism or most other religions for that matter?
Well, I can and I do, and I mean the genocide in Rwanda is a shocking scandal. 80% of them were Catholics. The pedophilia is not just a Catholic phenomenon. It's right through our society. We don't apologize. We do apologize. We don't try to deny the terrible things. But it's not just Stalin was an atheist. So was Lenin. So Mao was an atheist. So was Pol Pot. Now, the evils that Christians have done have been against the in terms of violence and that, against the teachings of Christ. Many of the evils that were perpetrated by those atheists were to build a better world. We've been going 2,000 years. There's 1,200,000 Catholics. There's plenty of opportunity to find errors. But if you do a little bit of history and have a look at what life it was like in Roman times and life now, you have a look at what life is like, especially for a baby, for women in China today, and see how that compares with the way we live and to Christian principles, you'll see that we've got our nose in front.
Thank you, Cardinal Pell.
Question for Dan.
Dan, what is your rationale for the things around us so simply that we can't understand and science will never have an explanation for? For instance, the path of the planets around the sun, the simplicity of a rhododendron opening its petals at a particular time in November each year in this country. What is the rationale that makes us love? I don't think a man can create that from outside. What is the rationale for the response to human emotions that are what I call good and sacred? You know, what is the explanation that you offer for those things coming into place for which there is no discernible scientific result?
Thank you. By the way, if you're going to excuse Christianity because of the atrocities of Christians by saying they weren't really true Catholics or true Christians or they wouldn't have done these things, well, then I can just say Stalin was not really a true atheist, right? What a silly tactic. Why are there, is our approach to truth to stack up the bodies and then just pick the smaller stack? Why does Christianity even have a stack in the first place? Morality is determined by harm. Stalin was a horrible person. Your question about science is exactly what drives science. Science is driven by unanswered questions. It is that drive to know. Yes, there are many unanswered questions, but I'm not going to be irresponsible and just plug it with my favorite answer and say there. I'm not going to take the gap, and there are many good scientific gaps to explain things, and just plug it with my particular God, be it Allah or Jehovah or Jesus or whatever. That is intellectually and morally irresponsible. It's better to say, we don't know yet, and isn't that wonderful? That gives us scientists more to do. Scientists are closing the gaps. We are learning more. And you should revel in the fact that there are unanswered questions because it gives us some purpose in our lives.
Question to Mr. Barker. Oh, Cardinal Pell. Go either way. It's been brought up in the atheist argument that science is sorting that out, and I think that is a close to a quote from Mr. Barker. Is that not explaining mystery with mystery, the very thing that Mr. Barker has accused you of doing? Your Eminence.
Well, as I've said three or four times, apparently not very successfully, science can only answer questions that fall within its terms of reference. As Stephen Hawking, who is a theist, Hawking said, the question is, why does the universe bother to exist? And he said, the answer you give to that you might call God. And that's what we do. We say it's a supreme intelligence. We also say that that God is loving. Now, whether it's the principle of natural selection or epigenetics, or we're learning more and more and more. And as I quoted Flew became a theist because of the great mysteries that science has discovered with DNA, that little bundle of itsy things that so comprehensively patterns so much of our existence and enables us to exercise free will. If we're animals, animals don't have free will. If we were machines, purely material, that there's no free will. Animals have instincts which they follow blindly, but they don't have free will because they're unable to know the difference between good and evil.
And the final question for Dan.
Hello, Dan. I found it interesting towards the end of your talk that you mentioned that part of living the good life in the here and now, because there is no judgment, is that unlike Cardinal Pell, that you're a father. What would you say of someone's life like Mother Teresa, who didn't actually bear a child? Did she not live a good life? Did she not add some good to other people's lives?
By the way, I do admire people who are voluntarily childless. I think the world is overpopulated, and we should be giving awards to those people. And we should be giving awards to the gay community as well, for the same reason. Mother Teresa was an exaggerated PR machine for the Roman Catholic Church. She did some good. She did some good. She was not a horrible person, but it was grossly exaggerated. Any men who went to her clinics and saw her work realized that it was a place to die. I have reports of reporters and workers and followers of hers who were in her clinics who actually complained bitterly. Her primary purpose was religious. It was not to really help people. She said, I think the sufferings of the poor help the world. The poor are here to suffer because suffering glorifies God. She had her head in the clouds. She did some good things, but millions of people have done better or more praiseworthy things than Mother Teresa ever did. Her genius was in taking that false image of her exaggerated importance and the Catholic Church using it to raise millions of unaccountable dollars that most of them went not into charity. Most of those dollars went into her nun convents to establish a religious order. She was a good person, but she was not a great woman and does not deserve the honorific that our world has been falsely giving to her.
That brings us to an end of today's debate. I would like to thank both speakers for giving up their time today for a very interesting and at times very controversial debate. And I now declare the debate closed, and I'll just hand over very quickly to Ryder to give the formal thank yous and such.
Thank you very much, Nick. So that concludes the proceedings this morning. But before you leave, I just want to bring a few things to your attention. Firstly, our invited speakers and guests and organisers are invited to a light luncheon in the foyer following this debate. Secondly, it will be possible to buy Dan's book if someone is interested. He'll be available for a signing as well. I should also mention that Cardinal Pell has written a new book that will be released in April, if I'm not too mistaken. Can you confirm that? Yes, in April. Thirdly, I would like to express my sincere gratitude to our distinguished speakers, Cardinal George Pell and Mr. Dan Barker, for taking the time to be here today. I would also like to extend my warm thanks to the Catholic Archdiocese of Sydney for facilitating Cardinal Pell's appearance today, the Secular Student Alliance and the Freedom from Religion Foundation in the States for supporting Dan Barker's trip to Australia. The always kind and helpful staff at Campus Experience, or formerly known as UNMQ. Mr. Nick Ferrari from the Debating Society for moderating today's debate. And the many volunteers from the Catholic Society and the Atheist League for working behind the scenes. A warm thanks to all of you. Finally, I would like to express my thanks to everyone in the audience for making this a memorable and inspiring experience. Thank you for being here.
You're listening to XT3.com.